Welcome to what is the 9th annual Access Lecture at UNIV. It's my very great pleasure to welcome Anna Vignolis as our speaker this evening. She is a Professor of Education and Director of Research and Education at Cambridge. Her background is in economics. She trained as an economist at Newcastle. She applies economic analysis to large databases in order to address a wide range of questions about the benefits of secondary and higher education and about equitable access to those benefits. Her work has critical relevance to public policy in such areas as the impact of school resources on pupil achievement, on the socioeconomic gap in pupil achievement, on the economic value of school and higher education, on differences in higher education participation across different socioeconomic groups, and of course on access to higher education. Not surprisingly, she is quite a familiar figure in Whitehall and Westminster, being frequently called upon to advise government departments, parliamentary select committees, and review bodies, notably the 2010 Brown Review of Higher Education Funding, that led via a slightly crooked path to the large increase in tuition fees later in that government. Opinions, of course, about the purpose and value of higher education used to be left to academics and educational leaders. No longer. Nowadays, politicians, commentators, lobbyists have all got in on the act, arguing assertively on the basis, it seems to me, very often of precious little evidence or on selective interpretation of what evidence they have to hand. So today's Independent reports that Robert Halfen, MP, the chair of the Commons Education Committee, in a lecture to the Centre of Social Justice, declared that for many graduates the returns on their degree are paltry, that between a fifth and a third of graduates currently take non-graduate jobs, that the graduate premium varies wildly from subject to subject, that the country should end its obsession with degrees. He's also very critical of the value of degrees in humanities. He himself went to the University of Exeter, where he studied politics, and then to SOAS, where he studied the politics of Eastern Europe and Russia. I just add that as a footnote. He called for a major expansion of degree apprenticeships, and universities, he says, which fail to offer them should lose some of their public funding. Well, how much of what he has said is true? What he says has been said by many other commentators on higher education. We may find out a little in a moment. Anna Vignolis looks at the evidence, examines the data, and interprets it dispassionately. And on that basis, I think she's going to give us a very informative lecture.
Thank you very much, and also a huge thank you for inviting me to come and talk about one of my favourite topics, namely widening participation. I hope I can be dispassionate, and I will present evidence on various aspects of widening participation. I should say, if anybody can't hear me, do yell and I shall move over to the microphone, but is the volume okay at the back? My work is with a number of different collaborators, and some of the things that I'm going to talk about today have been done with the colleagues that you see listed there. But before we get stuck into data, which is my other favourite thing, I thought that it would be important to think about some of these conceptual issues. We need to really think long and hard about what we're trying to achieve with widening participation. And as the Master has just said, increasingly expectations about what universities can do for students and for the wider world are being debated in many circles. Lots of debate about whether we offer for value for money, for example. But there's also a lot of discussion about whether we should expand higher education, how we should fund higher education, how we should improve access to higher education, And underneath all that, what role universities have to play in tackling some of the access issues in particular. And I think some of the discussion that goes on those topics is actually very contradictory, and hopefully I'll unpack some of that today. So first question, what are we actually trying to achieve when we talk about widening participation? And I think there are two answers to this question. There's the straightforward answer, which is obviously we would like students to have the opportunity to go to university if they're going to benefit from that higher education, irrespective of, say, their socioeconomic background or their ethnicity. So our job is, if you like, to make sure that students who would benefit from higher education can actually get into higher education. And not just any higher education, but also the full range of higher education institutions, including elite institutions such as Oxford and Cambridge. And if we take that as our definition of widening participation, we're thinking that we should be doing more to understand why poorer students are unrepresented in higher education. We should be identifying the barriers. We should be trying to fix them. But I think increasingly, actually, when people are talking about higher education, they don't see it simply as an important issue about access. They see it as being about social mobility. So in other words, we want to see students from non-traditional backgrounds participating in university, going on to flourish in the labour market, and most crucially, moving up in terms of socioeconomic status. So I think if there's that expectation of higher education, the first thing we should do is really start to ask ourselves, is education really a route to social mobility? And today I'm going to talk about some of the evidence on that. But just to sort of get ahead of myself, this was a question that I was recently asked by the House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee, which is looking at how we fund tertiary and what skills we need for the economy, and very much sort of along the lines of, have we got too many graduates and should we be expanding vocational education? But the question was, is education a solution? Is education a solution to our social mobility problem? Is education a solution to our inequality problem? Certainly education has been seen as this great enabler, way of ensuring that poor students can progress to the very top of our society in terms of income and social status. And the question is that a reality? Now, obviously, everybody will know it has been a reality for women, for example, in recent generations. There's no doubt that higher education is a route to job mobility, social mobility. It's also true that for many, higher education has indeed proved to be a really important route to high wages and to high status jobs. And I think this is something that we can't duck. It is almost certainly the case, almost universally the case, that those who do make it into higher education from poor backgrounds go on to do well in the labour market, or putting it the other way around, when you look at people who are succeeding in the labour market, most of them have got there via high status higher education. So higher education is a pivotal link in the chain of progression. And as you can see from some of the data here, now bear in mind, I'm picking the extremes to make a point here, there's no doubt that in our graduate group, having just heard that lots of degrees are not valuable and they give you low earnings, there is a group that's benefiting hugely from higher education in terms of their earnings. And those earnings are quite, you know, startlingly high. Those are the data for LSE, Oxford and Cambridge. But actually, they're outliers. If you think about focusing on people who come from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds and who make it into higher education. The reality is if you look across the piece at a wider set of data, education certainly hasn't been the great leveller that everybody hoped it would be. And I mean by that the strength of the relationship between your family background and whether you go to university is extremely strong. So whether you measure it in terms of family income, the correlation between your family income and your own income, or whether you measure it in terms of your family's highest level of education and your highest level of education, we have a really strong relationship in this country, and stronger than in many other OECD countries. So we have this intergenerational persistence, which is why, although we have expanded higher education, we still can't say that it's proven to be a route to social mobility for the vast majority of individuals. So one of the problems I think we have is that we're not very clear on what social mobility we would like to see. Or maybe we're clear about what we would like to see, but we're unclear about what we're actually seeing. And there are actually sort of three arguments that people make, often interchangeably, about the role of education in social mobility. So what do we think we mean when we talk about social mobility? What would it look like if we achieved social mobility? There are two versions of this story. So first of all, we use education to achieve relative social mobility. And that means some people make room at the top for others from poor socioeconomic backgrounds. And whether that means some of our students who come from high SES backgrounds no longer get into Oxford and Cambridge, or indeed any Russell group, and they are displaced by students from poorer backgrounds, or whether we mean it in terms of jobs, that some of our High Court judges will come from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds, and those who currently come from high status socioeconomic backgrounds will make way for them. And that's one definition that we mean. And in fact, it was a definition that was used by David Willetts in some of his speeches. And I always thought at the time that it's an ambition that seems unlikely, that this particular definition of social mobility is really quite a difficult thing to achieve. But another definition, absolute social mobility, is a different type of story. The idea is that actually, when the period in our country that we did see some growth in the proportions of people using university to get to higher status jobs was when we were expanding the number of good jobs, graduate jobs, that were available. So if we use our education system to improve the skills of our workforce, if we stimulate our economy, if we produce lots of good jobs, and we ensure that students from poor backgrounds can get access to that higher education, then I think we have a chance of achieving the absolute social mobility that many of us would want to see. But they're two very different versions of it. And then there's this final one, which is perhaps the most disturbing of all, which is we know that in the UK we have a high level of income inequality compared to many of our OECD competitors. So we're a bit more similar to America than we are to, say, Norway. Now, if we're a bit more like America and everybody gets an equal chance of getting some of those high incomes, we might be relatively relaxed. On the other hand, if we're like America with high income inequality and certain people have a very low chance of getting those high incomes, then we're more concerned. But what I'm really worried about is that actually education is part of that process, and education, in a sense, legitimizes inequality in the sense that we can still see ourselves as meritocratic because those high-paid jobs that you see in the city or in the city or in, you know, the legislature or whatever, the high-status jobs are being taken by the people with the most education. So it's meritocratic, it's fair. These people worked hard, they studied hard, they got more education, they proceeded to those top jobs. But as a consequence of that, do we ignore the inequality that we're seeing in the labour market and the consequences of that for those who don't make it into those jobs? So I'm going to come back to this at the end, but one of my questions is, can we start to think a bit more clearly about what it is that we're striving for, and in particular, whether we need to worry about the third point more than we have done in the past? So I promise I'll get to some data in a minute, but just before I do that, I think there's also a sort of theoretical point to make here, which is, what do we think from theory and from empirical evidence that education is doing for us in our economic system? And at this point I should say education serves many, many purposes, as we all know, and I'm sure we're all committed to. So although I'm focusing on the economic purpose of education, that's not to imply that I don't think that education has a much broader aim. But focusing on the economic role of education just for a moment, there are different theoretical explanations for the role of education in the economy. There is reasonably good empirical evidence to provide some support for human capital theory. Human capital theory is nice because it suggests that if we invest in education, we make our workforce more skilled, more productive, and that might take us to the scenario that I outlined earlier with more good jobs at the top and for absolute social mobility. But there is another aspect to our education system that I'm sure you're all familiar with, which is this idea that actually education is just signalling. What it is doing is identifying to employers the smartest people in our society. And increasingly what we're doing is we're educating people for longer, so that now you have to have a postgraduate degree to signal your higher level of ability. So we're spending more, and the argument would go that this is somewhat of a waste, because you're not actually improving productivity per se, you're just getting into this qualification race. As I said, there is no definitive empirical evidence that human capital theory is 100% correct. There is empirical evidence to support aspects of it. My view is that it's a bit of both, but with an emphasis on human capital theory. And there's a third set of explanations about the role of education for sociologists in the room. People like Bourdieu argued for a long time that education is partly about acquiring social capital. And more crucially, when we think about widening participation, it's easier for someone with social capital to access education. And so that, again, has implications for the way we think about education, because it wouldn't imply necessarily that education is enhancing our economy. So I'm an optimist, and I think I'll go with human capital theory being a major explanation. But I think we need to be mindful of these alternatives, because when people are questioning the value of higher education, they become very salient. So having spent a bit of time thinking about, okay, so what do we think the purpose of education is? What are we striving for? Can we show some evidence that might help us understand what we're actually looking at in terms of widening participation and fair access? So I'm going to talk about some of the work that we've done. And we have imperfect measures of the socioeconomic background of our students in our data. And the reason for this is we use large-scale administrative data records. And as many of you will know, they're great and they're comprehensive, and we can claim to have a census. But the downside is that we don't have, nice measures like social class or precise measures of family income. And I'm very mindful of the work that's done here at Oxford by Urzbek Bacody and John Goldthorpe with very rich measures of social class. And the distinctions that you make on how you measure socioeconomic background do matter. But I take a pragmatic view in this research, because that's what I have. What do we find? So we have in the data very large gaps in attainment between different socioeconomic groups. No doubt about that. Every data set you look at, every time period you look at, there's a very large socioeconomic gap. The gap widens during primary school. That can often be interpreted to mean that primary schools are doing a very bad job. We don't know that, because the counterfactual might be that it would widen even more if they weren't doing what they're doing. But it widens during primary school and on entry into secondary school. And we're also seeing large gaps in terms of HE participation. And so I'm just going to show you some of the evidence on that. So this is what it looks like across the different age groups. So as we go from left to right, the child is getting older. This is longitudinal, age 7, 11, 14, etc., right through to university in the far right bar. And what we're showing is the average sort of percentile ranking on various measures and test scores. They're not directly comparable, obviously, because the test at 16 looks quite different from the test at 7. But what we've done is rank everybody according to their percentile ranking and tried to understand where do people from different socioeconomic groups sit. So the red line at the top is the high socioeconomic group, blue line at the bottom, low socioeconomic group, and the bars are the magnitude of the gap between the high and the low SES groups. So here it's sort of very visible, I think, this point that I was making, that even by age 7, you've got a massive socioeconomic gap, nearly 50 percentage points, between the high SES group and the low SES group. Then it widens through primary. So you then see them in secondary at age 14, which is the first point that you actually observe them in secondary school. That gap is widening considerably. And then it stabilises. So that's the first piece of data. Gaps emerge early. But when we use survey data from the British cohort studies of various types, and we can put it together reasonably well and examine those socioeconomic gaps, again, across the child's development from age 3 to age 16. And the same thing, the blue bar at the top is the highest socioeconomic group and the yellow bar at the bottom is the lowest socioeconomic group. So what this shows you, that in fact those gaps that we saw in the school system at 7 are manifest by age 3 when we take this kind of data. And again, just in case you worried about the other data being administrative, this is rich survey data with much better measures, and we still see this widening of the socioeconomic gap on entry into secondary school. That's important because it doesn't seem an obvious point that you would get a significant worsening of the socioeconomic gap just at that point in a child's level of development. If you ask psychologists, they would expect it to come early. So our explorations around on this gap suggest it's the school that you attend that's making a difference. So when you go into secondary school, what you're finding is that at that point, children sort by socioeconomic background to a much greater extent, and so poor kids are ending up in different secondary schools to rich kids, and as a consequence, you're getting these large gaps. So what does that look like if we roll forward and think about participation in university? So this is straightforward. We're looking at low SES, low socioeconomic status, to high socioeconomic status, and the pale blue bars, are participation in university, and the smaller bars are participation in what we've classified as a high status institution, and by that we mean Russell Group or equivalent in terms of their research ranking. So it's not a completely self-defined group. We have judged them to be high status on the basis of their research performance. You can do the same analysis on the basis of teaching performance. It's not quite as clear, but a similar pattern emerges. And so it's basically looking at the percentage of state school students from those different socioeconomic backgrounds who go to university. You can see the relationship is virtually linear. Clearly, the higher socioeconomic status you are, the more likely you are to go to university. And the gaps are considerable, both in terms of HU participation and elite institution. But that's, you probably knew that already. What's more important, I think, is to think about why or whether we can explain those large socioeconomic gaps. And that's what this is trying to do. So on the left, we have the raw gap. It's what you saw on the previous slide. So you've got 37 points, percentage points, for the gap for going to university, and 18 percentage points the gap for going to an elite university. So those are the raw on that graph with a slightly bigger sample. And then what we do is we allow, we control for test scores at various ages. So here what we're asking is, what's the likelihood of going to university for people who have similar levels of ability or achievement at age 7? Here, likewise, what's the likelihood or going to university, or the gap between poor and rich, if you allow for their ability at 11, 16, and 18. And so what you can conclude from this is, by the time you get to age 16, if you compare students who have the same test scores at 16, there's virtually no gap in the likelihood of going to university. In other words, poor kids and rich kids are equally likely to go to university if they get the same GCSE scores. Now, there is a gap in terms of high status institutions. It's not massive, but there is a gap. So rich students are marginally more likely to go to a high status institution, even if you're comparing them with other students who have exactly the same level of GCSE test scores. And likewise, when you get through to A level. So in other words, the gaps emerge. They emerge early, and prior achievement through the school system is explaining most of the reason why we don't see larger numbers of poor kids ending up at university. And obviously the implication of that is, if we're going to fix something, we need to think about how we level the playing field during primary and secondary school and do more to raise the test scores and achievement and academic learning of poor kids. The other thing is, some of you might be sitting there going, well, isn't the fee issue quite a big problem? And reference to the Brown Review earlier, are we thinking that fees might be, in some sense, putting off poorer students from going to university? So the answer is, as yet, fees have not done this. This is some nice analysis by my colleague Claire Crawford, looking at, again, sort of similar picture, the gap, socioeconomic gap, in the likelihood of going to high-status universities over time. And you will all know that at this point here, fees were introduced. Well, we had fees prior to that, but a big increase in fees to £3,000. And you barely see it in the data. There's no evidence that introducing fees had a dramatic impact on the participation of the poor kids. And there's some nice work that I can get the graph for from Murphy, just published, who've also showed that the 2012 fee hike, which was obviously considerably greater, might have impacted on poor students, doesn't seem to have widened that socioeconomic gap. So, I mean, just to be very clear, I'm not suggesting that this will stay the same forever. I'm not suggesting that if you kept hiking fees that you wouldn't see behaviour differences, and that it may well be that poor kids become more and more debt-averse and then choose not to participate in university. But what I'm saying is, as yet in the data, we're not seeing that actually happen. Okay, so far we've talked about getting into university. What happens after you achieve access? Because obviously the goal here, going back to what I said earlier, is not simply to go to university and learn, it's also to think about succeeding in university and going on to do well in the labour market. And those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds are indeed more likely to drop out, less likely to complete their degree, less likely to get a top grade. And I mean by that when you compare like for like. So taking two equally well-qualified students, the dropout rate, for example, from poor students is greater. Now, you might say, why mention this? Isn't this, you know, how is this relevant? Well, I think it's very relevant when we start to ask our questions about what do we mean by widening participation, or more crucially, what should universities be doing on the widening participation front? Because it may be that some of our efforts need to be focused not so much on getting people into the door, through the door, because that's primarily down to the fact that we need better school-level achievement from poor kids. But what can we do when some of those students do make it into university? What can we do to support them? And are these activities, in fact, just as important? And now we come to the bit which the Master mentioned earlier about what happens when you go beyond higher education into the labour market. I think this is where, you know, the widening participation project is important, but also it's very clear what we need to do to kind of determine how we judge its success. What we were hoping, I guess, to see was that graduates from lower socioeconomic backgrounds would succeed well in the labour market. What we in fact see is a rather large gap in earnings, I'll show you. So the data we're using for this is, again, this is administrative data, slightly different administrative data. We were lucky enough to have access to student loan company information linked to HMRC tax records. So we can look at all the UK domiciled graduates, at least, who have borrowed from the student loan company, and then we can follow them a decade into the labour market. So we can see their earnings over their first 10 years of their career. We don't have that many students. We've only got 260,000 because it's a 10% subsample. We now have access to the full census of students through the Department for Education, and we're doing some work to update this. But for this analysis, we only have a 10% subsample. So there are lots of slides I could show you. This is the basic point, which is, despite what you're reading in the newspapers about the low return to degrees, on average, there is still very much a positive return to degrees. In fact, actually, the really interesting point is not just our study, but other studies are suggesting that the return to a degree has not fallen, on average. So the labour market demands graduate-level skill, sufficiently at least, to keep that graduate wage premium relatively high. What was referred to earlier, however, is the growing realisation that within that average, we're seeing a lot of variation. So it is true there is substantial variation in earnings by subject, and it is also true that the subjects that suffer are creative arts, not so much humanities, but creative arts. But it's also the case that, by and large, there isn't a massive difference in average earnings across most subjects. So you have creative arts as an outlier with very low earnings, and maybe that's not to be, that's to be expected to some degree. But also at the top end, you have medicine, you have economics, which is a massive positive outlier with very high earnings. But other than that, actually, there's perhaps less variation in subject than we might have anticipated. You also see variation by institution, and I'm afraid you'll have to wait till the summer before we can publish all that. But our preliminary published work is available online with some of that data if you're interested. But for the purposes of widening participation, understanding that graduate salaries vary by institution is not really the important point. I think this is the important point. When you compare students who come from relatively less advantaged backgrounds, so we're separating out here the very wealthy, the top fifth, from everybody else. The top fifth of students the wealth distribution earn around about 30% more than everybody else if they're male, and around about just under 25% more if they're female. So that's a pretty hefty premium. But of course, some of that premium earned by the very children from very wealthy families is actually down to the fact that they have higher levels of academic achievement. They're going to more elite universities, so maybe that's not a fair test. So the pale bars there are after the controls are added. So those represent the wage premium, the graduate wage premium, for those from high socioeconomic backgrounds. After you've allowed for the fact that they've got higher levels of academic achievement. So what we're seeing here, in a nutshell, is that if you come from a high socioeconomic background, on average you earn around about 10% more than your colleagues who graduated from the same university in the same subject. So, depending on who you are, that either comes as a surprise or it doesn't. And quite a few people have said, well, I didn't expect anything else. But I think we need to think about why, and some of the why there might be better access to postgraduate provision, better access to internships, the ability to have income coming in so that you can take your time getting a job and choose the right job for you with a career prospect that's really good. But it also raises the question, coming back to what should widening participation be about, not only should it be about the achievement of poorer kids when they're in university, but potentially here we're saying it should also be about maybe supporting poorer students as they make that transition into the labour market. Because if we're keen for higher education to be a route to social mobility, what our data is suggesting is it's not enough just to get students through the door. You need to perhaps support them while they're here and beyond. So moving to the more practical side of things, what should we actually do? I mean, you know, we've laid out the data, we know what the problem is. What can we actually do about it? So I think the really obvious point is that if we're serious about this, we need to improve the achievement of poor kids from an early age. We're only really going to transform the system if we achieve that. There's no substitute for the hard work of actually tackling inequality in the school system. And if we duck that, we will always have the case where our high-status universities are scrabbling around trying to find well-qualified but relatively poor students, and there just aren't enough of them. My fear in the widening participation debate is that governments would prefer to spend relatively modest sums of money on widening participation activities, or more precisely, they will get universities to spend, you know, modest sums on widening participation activities, rather than spending big sums on trying to reduce the inequalities that are earlier in the system. So, for example, you could spend an awful lot on early years interventions to try and ensure that the poorest kids come into school without that great big gap that you saw at age three. That would be a logical use of the kinds of investment that you might want to make. But that's very expensive. And so I think there's a danger there. But, that said, I'm certainly not suggesting that we should stop our widening participation activities at all. And there are reasons why universities have a very, very active role to play in this space. The first thing we know from Archer and Goodman and Greg and others Aspiration is an issue, aspiration amongst certain groups of students. And one thing universities can do is try and convince students of the value of education and the value of effort at school. And that actually might be part of the way that we raise achievement at school as well, by allowing kids to envisage what they could achieve when they look forward, and include that, you know, higher education participation in that. So that's important. The other thing is that students from poorer backgrounds certainly don't benefit from the social networks that others have. And Slack and all have done a really nice study suggesting that what many sort of parents take, who've been to university, take for granted in the way of guidance and support for students during the university process, poorer students lack. And so that again is a role for universities to kind of step in there with their widening participation activity to help students through that. I think we also maybe need to think the unthinkable and work out whether we have quicker solutions. By quicker, I mean rather than wait 15, 20 years to improve the achievement of poor kids in the school system, should we be doing more to contextualise admissions so that we're giving poorer kids a boost to get them into higher status universities? Some of you may be sitting there saying, well, I think we do that already. I think it varies by university, and it's definitely not transparent. Once enrolled in university, our data and data previously by Hoare and going back to actually the 1990s by Robin Naylor suggests that kids from poor backgrounds, and particularly kids from state schools, actually do better at university if you compare them with similarly qualified students from more privileged backgrounds or independent schools. So there is a clear justification for saying that actually poor kids have not done so well at school, they haven't had the support, but if you let them into universities, the way we teach seems to allow poorer kids to excel and get good grades. So should that be a justification for contextualised admissions? I mean, the other thing is I'm mindful also of work done here by Vicky Bolliver and colleagues who've got access to UCAS data and can look at the admissions behaviour of poor students. And perhaps unsurprisingly, they find that poor students and minority ethnic students are far less likely to even apply to Russell Group institutions than their comparably qualified counterparts. That's true. But also they find that they're less likely to get offers of admission. And that certainly raises some challenges across the Russell Group as to why that might be the case. And one of the questions I had was, is this consistent with what I see in my data? And in my data, it looks like in most Russell Group institutions, on average, poor kids are getting in with lower grades. So in my data, the average grade of a student from a poor background on the same course as a student from a rich background is lower. So for a long time, we puzzled and we thought, you know, are we wrong? Are we competing? I think they're consistent. I think what's happening is that poorer kids are making their grade offers. Richer kids overshoot their grade offer by a greater amount. So what you're seeing in the system is indeed a difference in the grades of richer and poorer students, but it doesn't necessarily mean we're seeing lots of contextualised admissions going on in the system. But that is a deduction from data. It is not based on an empirical study of what's actually happening on the ground, and I think that work really needs to be done. We need to understand why candidates who seem to have the same subject profiles, seem to have the same grades, have an unequal chance of admission. And one thing I think we should really give serious thought to, especially having now moved to Cambridge and worked there, we have to entertain the notion that this might not be overt discrimination. It can be unforeseen consequences of some of the way that we admit students, which frankly is a bit bizarre. We do it on the basis of predicted grades. If we had a post-A-level admission system, at least you'd be confident that the data on which decisions are being made is real data and is an actuality. And maybe that's what we need to think about in terms of understanding and overcoming this problem. So what else should we be doing? The other thing, we're not going to wait to solve the school inequality problem. We should try to, but I don't think we can wait. But what we do need to do in the meantime with all the widening participation activity is really think about what we're doing, try to undertake the best programs we can. And in order to do that, we really need to have evidence. We need to have evaluation evidence of what actually makes a difference. it's great that the government's requiring universities to spend more on widening participation, but we've been here before. We've had other national initiatives, including Aim Higher, and much of that money was wasted, because wasted, I don't mean in the sense of bad intentions, but just we didn't evaluate and we weren't sure of the impact that it's having. And in some institutions, if you asked people on the ground, they'd be fairly confident it wasn't necessarily having a positive impact, but it was demonstrating activity. And we need to move away from demonstrating activity to actually demonstrating impact. So I've been involved in an interesting project funded by OFFA, not doing it, just advising, and the Sutton Trust. And they've tried to think quite seriously about what evaluation should look like in this space. Some of you may be familiar with the work of the Sutton Trust, and they also have links with partly co-owned by the Education Endowment Foundation. And the Education Endowment Foundation has what they call a schools toolkit. So it's a kind of online resource for teachers who can go to the schools toolkit and ask, what should I be doing to help poorer kids achieve better in my school? And they can click and get some decent, robust evaluation evidence. There's nothing equivalent for widening participation, and there really should be. We need that kind of repository of good, evidenced interventions that other people have tried and work, and we need to spread that good practice around the system. Encouragingly, Crawford's work suggested that actually most institutions were evaluating, 40% using before and after designs, far fewer using a control group design, but nonetheless, encouraging that evaluation is definitely moving in the right direction. And more crucially, I think the offer activity has generated some standards. People can now go and look at them. And at Cambridge, at least, my colleague Sonia, who's sitting in the audience, is working extensively with our admissions team and others doing widening participation activity to try and embed some of those standards of evaluation into widening participation activity. And I would say that's something maybe academics need to think about. We have academic expertise on evaluation sitting in all our good universities. It would usefully be applied to the widening participation space, and working together, I think, is very fruitful on that. So what specific widening participation activities should we be doing? This is where it gets far more tricky, and I'm certainly not going to be able to do a survey of all the things that we might do in this space and what proves to be effective. But I think it's quite interesting to think of an exemplar of how you might approach this issue. There's evidence from the US that low-cost interventions, personalised interventions aimed at students, can make a difference to their behaviour and obviously to their participation. And this, for example, there's this nice study by Castleman and Page where they're targeting high school students, they're sending them text messages, they're sending parents text messages. They're trying to get students with their minds on higher education application and prompt them and support them in the process. Now, I mentioned this not because that's the only widening participation activity you should do, but I think it's really interesting because this was properly evaluated. You could see a causal impact. It was done with a nice research design. And we need more of this to happen in the English system. And again, colleagues Sonia Illy and others at Cambridge are trying to take this approach to the regional hub that they have there, where we're trying to widen the participation across East Anglia. And we need to be thinking about randomised control trials. We need to be thinking about large-scale longitudinal surveys, linked administrative data, following these kids in the administrative data through time, so we can really see what's happening on the ground as a result of all this widening participation activity. And that's actually precisely what they're doing. So they're working with lots of schools in East Anglia. And I know you had Danny Dorling come 1 year about the importance of place in higher education participation. Well, East Anglia, or this bit of East Anglia, has quite major issues. And in their baseline survey, looking at reasons why students don't think they're going to participate, or the barriers that they might have to HE participation, boys and girls come up with roughly the same answers, which is this indecision about what they want to do, the draw of the labour market, which is ironic given the employment rate for unqualified people in that region at that age is relatively low. It's a low employment rate, but nonetheless, this draw to the labour market. And some kind of unsure about whether it's appealing and uncertainty about grades. So this really comes through. And those are the kinds of problems that are not about money necessarily. They're not about geography. They're about information. And so I think it's logical that we should think very seriously about information interventions. And what they're doing is they're doing a randomised control trial where they're sending text to one group and not the other, so that you can see the impact of prompting and guidance and the provision of information on participation behaviour, a reasonably big sample of Year 13 students. And so this is very much in line with the sort of behavioural nudge theory. Do I think it's going to transform, you know, higher education participation in this country? Clearly not. But I think one of the things we have is that if we're talking about marginal decisions by students who are properly qualified to attend university, this is the kind of intervention that might make a difference. And certainly, you know, given the low costs of delivering it, it's something we should think about very seriously. And then finally, thinking about beyond HE, it's crucial that we think of the next stage as people going into the labour market. And just leave you with, on this point, another sort of pessimistic note. We need to be worrying now about postgraduate admissions and postgraduate opportunities. So essentially, we have moved some of the widening participation problems into the next level of education, which is an issue that we've not yet been able to take seriously enough, I think. So just to end, what do I think about education as a solution, if you like? What's the role of education? Education can solve some of our problems, but I think the evidence is very clear. It's not currently a route to social mobility. Family background is still mattering a huge amount, and I'm not claiming that the education system isn't meritocratic. It can be entirely meritocratic, but the wealthy are getting more out of that system because of their better preparation for university. And you know, if we're going to fix that, there are some dramatic things we could do. I did suggest we might remove subsidy for childcare for higher earners, for example, and use that money to spend more on early years provision for students from poor, for young children from poor backgrounds. These are all challenging, you know, politically, but it's certainly true that at the moment education is not necessarily doing what it's doing to promote social mobility. But I think the other thing is about income inequality. If parents feel that the gap between a good job and a bad job is massive, and the economic consequences of your child not going to university is pretty dire, then obviously parents will fight to make sure their kids come out on top of the, you know, on top of the tree. And it's a natural thing that happens. So what we do need to think about is, do we need to reduce income inequality if we're going to solve some of the other problems? Because at the moment it feels like there's a great fear of falling from those who have succeeded in the higher education system, and that will limit what we can do to widen participation. So let's focus on inequality, let's think about better jobs, let's think about labour market regulation. And more positively perhaps, if I'm right that human capital theory is the major explanation for the role of education in our labour market, then expanding education in the sense of genuinely producing a more skilled workforce should have economic benefits. And that's a good enough reason to invest in education, quite apart from all the other benefits that you get from education beyond earnings. You can invest it because it improves the economy and everything else. So if we're taking that route, okay, so we invest in education, and alongside that, we need to think about other economic factors. We can't just use education as the solution to everything. So we need to think about low productivity. We need to think about labour market regulation. We haven't got enough capital investment. Our employer training is dire. So all of these things come together in the mix. And I think that focusing on making people more productive is definitely the way to go. But perhaps not relying quite so much on education as the panacea for the economic inequality that we see in our society. So thank you very much.